as the facilitator, I thought that I'd be up here, but apparently I'm down there. So why don't I introduce everyone from up here, and then I'll join my friends down on the couch for a quiet little discussion between ourselves and 150 people here. On behalf of CEDR and the MJCC, thanks for all turning up tonight. It's a very cold night, and it's a bit of a hard place to reach. And I noticed as well, too, they're giving wine tastings up in Federation Square. So surprised to see any of you here at all, so well done. James Tuckerman is my name. I'm the editor and publisher of a business magazine called Australian Anthill. That's the latest edition. Get to the newsagents now. But to give some background about me and why I'm up here, aside from going to university and doing a law degree of 6 years of wasted lectures, after that I went and became a PR person in an investor relations sphere. I moved on from that investor relations sphere to PR in an issues-rich field at Telstra. Following that, I decided that I'd had enough of talking to the media and I'd become media myself, at which point I took the somewhat naive leap at the time of launching my own business magazine. And in a six-month period, I turned from PR flack to media hack. So I've gone from pitching to stories to hearing stories to making disparaging marks about the power of advertising against PR, to selling advertising and trying to manage our own business against all the PR people that are coming in, because there's a lot of good PR stories that come through. So that's my background as media PR flack turned media hack. We have three distinguished stars from the advertising, PR and marketing space. And I know how difficult it sometimes is for a host to accurately describe the guests that we have. So rather than reading through the notes that I have here, I thought that I'd ask some questions. Ron Barnacle at the end here, chairman of Clemenger Harvey Edge. That's a pretty impressive role.
Very.
It is. 25 years of industry experience. My notes say one of the industry's most respected marketing strategists.
I wrote it.
You wrote it. You can tell he's in marketing. Over those 25 years, what would you say are some of the highlights? What's a highlight and also one of the most rewarding accounts that you've worked on?
Probably the highlight is being in the industry right now, because it's going through profound change. We've never faced a period where the industry is going through such change on all levels. The media channels, technology driven, the way we go about communicating with consumers, just everything in our industry is changing. All, you know, everyone would have read stories about how the era of free-to-air television is dead. Well, it's not dead yet, but I mean, it used to be the cornerstone of the industry. Everyone wanted to be on television and make television commercials. And today it's, you know, almost overnight become passé, you know. So I suppose that's the... that's probably the highlight, albeit that it's recent. The most interesting client, I'm not sure I know how to answer that, but a recent one was our main business, CHE, did the Commonwealth Games, and that was a very exciting event because it had a lot to do with just not selling product or an idea. In that instance, the product was tickets. But it was about trying to engender a spirit into the state that would be a legacy of the games. And I think if you can do something that's commercially viable and at the same time contribute to the community, that's always rewarding. And so I guess that answers that question.
Thank you, Ron. At the other end of the seating, we have Anton Steindl.
Steindl.
German?
Yeah.
Yeah, wunderbar.
Anton is the founding partner of Haystack Public Affairs. Now, I was working, I believe, at Weber Shandwick Worldwide when Haystack was launched, and I went, what's this company with the funny name that continues to beat us and win all our accounts? I'm going to ask Anton a similar question to Ron, except it's almost much more fun when you talk to someone in PR, rather than asking Anton what was his most rewarding account, what has been your most controversial account?
That I can talk about.
Think carefully.
I think any... it's actually probably in the same space, the most rewarding and the most controversial, because it tends to be... the ones I enjoy most are the big public education social marketing campaigns, which tend to be funded by government. And anything that is... that involves government has the potential and the propensity to become controversial. And
I'm going to extract the spin here. By public education, he means where to put a toxic waste dump.
No, I'm actually talking about stop beating up your wife and okay. You know, stop dying on the roads. It's, you know, the better side of the public education, more the social marketing. But you know, when you have, for instance, a major domestic violence campaign which is aimed at young people, and you've sort of developed a program around that which you're really confident is going to communicate to young people, but it sort of involves acknowledging that young people have sex, and you're doing that for a conservative government with a very conservative prime minister who was sort of personally involved in the campaign, then there are all sorts of issues to manage there.
I won't make any comments. No jokes there. Speaking of jokes, in the middle we have Vanessa Roos, who's nothing but a joke. However, she is marketing and sponsorship director of the Comedy Festival.
Damn. Don't expect me to be funny. That's
Well, I was going to ask you, Vanessa, drawing on your current and previous roles, do you think you need a sense of humour in marketing?
In festivals, you definitely do. At the Comedy Festival, you wouldn't survive without it. Recently, I was having a lunch with Andrew Jaspin, who's CEO of The Age, and one of our artists, who was particularly hungover and just wanted to cause grief, put a slab of meat under his arm and sat opposite Andrew just to get his attention. Andrew wouldn't play, so he then crawled under the table, lifted my skirt up and bit me, just so that I would respond. So, yes,
you're taking notes?
You definitely do. Because I think you have to understand what the artists are doing. You have to understand what they're trying to do for people and themselves, and you have to understand where they're coming from, including their eccentricities.
Well, you've basically made my next question irrelevant, but it was a very leading question about your life before the Comedy Festival, which is, do you think in marketing you need to be theatrical?
Absolutely. In festivals, you definitely do. I mean, the thing about festivals, particularly government-funded ones, is that we do everything the smell of an oily rag. I mean, that just makes me laugh to think that anyone has $100,000 for research when that would be 20% of our annual funding from government to sustain 25 staff. So we have to do things differently, and I don't think we can compete with a lot of the other budgets, and that is where our strength is in the originality of the artists and what theatre you can actually bring to launches or sponsorship functions or any of those large-scale events.
I think we'll find that that originality being a key theme to all professions. No matter how much money you've got, originality seems to be key. I'm going to stroll over here. Be Jeffrey Robertson, or hypothetical. It feels very comfy over here. This is nice. Let's get back down to the basics. Well, first, let's find out who's here. Put up your hand if you work for a company. It's just about everyone. Put up your hand if you own a company. Put up your hand if you would like to own a company. All right. I ask that because there are different answers depending on where someone is what they're doing with their lives. For example, if you were all running your companies, you might be interested in a in a different level of marketing media PR response. If you're working for a company, it might be something different. Once again, if you're planning to build a company, you're probably shoestringing something on the weekends and at night, and then you'll need to know different things again. But to bring it back down to basics, let's go to the basics and just ask Ron at the end here, what is advertising? How would you define advertising?
Well, I think advertising can be easily defined as trying to move goods and services to the consumer, and in so doing, buying advertising space or time to do it. The buying being the bit that differentiates it from, say, PR or other marketing disciplines.
PR in a nutshell.
Yeah. I went to uni for 3 years and didn't come out knowing the answer to that. Any graduates here could help me out? I would say it's really the art of influencing opinion. Advertising does that. I think the marketing discipline does that. The space that we endeavour to do that is in supposedly unpaid media. Unpaid media, unpaid forums, as opposed to buying media space or buying endorsement. But I think that PR today is something which is nowhere near as clear-cut as that, because I think the discipline has really sort of the various streams of the one discipline have really grayed and are merging continuously. So I think there's a lot of, you know, hence the term marcoms has become sort of a common term bandied around now, because it's not just in that space. And I think what PR used to do, what advertising used to do, as very distinct functions, now blurs quite a bit.
So if it's blurred, marketing is the umbrella. And if marketing is the umbrella, what else falls under that umbrella? What other things keep you busy, Vanessa?
Any festival in Australia has a very different sort of scenario with any sort of product launch, in that the PR strategies are intrinsic and you have many, many stakeholders. So what keeps me busy is meeting government needs, meeting an economic impact study for the state of what the comedy festival provides, selling 350,000 tickets, plus also trying to get every bit of marketing for free because we have no money. So that's what keeps me busy. So, and also within that is advocating for those artists as well, and for their credential and their place within the community and within sort of economic models.
So to rely on an old analogy, and excuse me if you've heard it before, advertising's like me going up to the sexy girl at the bar and saying, "I'm James." PR is sending her friend over to the sexy girl at the bar and say, "See that guy over there? He's really nice. His name's James." And what you're talking about sounds like going up and saying, "Can I have a free drink?"
What I'm talking about is saying, wow, if those two people get together, then look at all these other things that happen. That's what happens at a festival.
Thank you. I have a question here, which is, which discipline do I use and when? Which don't I use? Now, that's a difficult question to answer. Ron, if you went in advertising, which do you think would be more effective, advertising or PR?
A lot of these questions don't have an easy answer, but the answer to this one is that it very much depends on the circumstances. For instance, if you want to move $50,000 in a week, toys in a week, the easy way to do that is buy some space or airtime and move those toys, those dolls. As Anton said before, if you want to influence public opinion on a certain matter, driving or drinking or whatever it is, then PR can be much more powerful and relevant. So it's very, and there are a whole lot of other marketing tools like sales promotion and so on. So they all have their own place and their own time and their own hierarchy depending on the circumstances. And I've just given you two examples of them. So there's no one answer about which one's more powerful. It's a question of what's appropriate at the time. But also, there's a synergistic effect. I mean, if you put advertising and PR together in the right circumstances, you'll have a much better outcome than advertising or PR without the other. So all, you know, there's no easy answer. I mean, that is the answer, but there's no black and white or, you know, this is what you do there and this is what you do somewhere else. I mean, for instance, if it's Anton's business does, like some of ours, crisis management. Well, yes, you can use advertising for crisis management, but generally speaking, PR is a more powerful and relevant tool if you're dealing with that particular aspect of a business or government or challenge, you know. So
now, you've used that word power and powerful. When it comes to things like advertising and PR and marketing, the first question that a client wants to always seem to ask is, how do you measure it?
Mm.
When you're running the festival, do you have KPIs and how do you measure what's working across the different aspects of a marketing spectrum?
We have a number of KPIs at the festival. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the first one is ticket sales. Then there would be economic impact. It would be artistic development. It would be visitation. There's probably about 30 of them that come from various government departments as well as ones from ourselves. So it's very hard just to put it into a nutshell.
So if you're running a PR campaign and someone says, we want to change the attitudes of Australian people, how do you value, put a measurement on your work?
It's sort of the holy grail of the PR industry, I think, is this whole thing about evaluating success or otherwise. I think in advertising generally it's an easier thing to do. In PR sometimes it's easy, but more often than not it's really difficult. And I think people are still grasping for what it is, you know, that there's going to be something out there that is going to be, you know, the definitive measure of whether money expended on PR has been effective or not. I don't think it's ever going to come. I think there actually is an element of gut feel to it as well.
Do your clients still measure you against column inches in newspapers, or has it changed somewhat since?
Some like to. I think that it's funny that we shy away from it as an agency, but invariably we end up doing it for clients who want it, and those clients who want it are the clients who themselves are justifying their own positions and want something that they can report up the line. I don't think there are many people who take it as a meaningful measure. And then there's some notional multiple that's put on there for the PR value as opposed to it being advertising, which I don't know how the hell anyone's plucked out sort of a multiple, but you know, people try it. It happens and it'll continue to happen because, as I say, I don't think the Holy Grail is actually out there on evaluating PR success, but it's there's not a lot of science behind it.
But all that said, I'm sorry.
No, that's right.
The truth
of
it is that you'd be reverent like that and you can be chairman one day.
Hang on, but I'm the moderator.
The truth of it is that successful companies use those tools. And whether you can measure it in any scientific way or as scientifically as you would like, the truth of it is that successful companies use those tools because they get a result from it and because it's an important part of their success. I'm not just talking about advertising and PR, but it might be sales promotion or word of mouth marketing or internet marketing. But those things are done for a reason, and they're either measured scientifically and quantitatively or they're measured anecdotally, i.e. through sales or the variation in the brand reputation or other measurements. So, you know, it's just a fact of life that we can't measure them as much as Anton and I would like, but the truth is they wouldn't be done if they didn't have a commercial benefit.
Yeah, it's exactly right. I mean, Vanessa was salivating before over a $100,000 research budget.
Mm.
And, I mean, ideally, in the perfect world, if you're about to embark on a major PR campaign, you would be investing in sort of benchmark research, and then you'd be going back and you'd be testing against that. But in the real world, there's often a lot of money associated with that that people rightly want to put into doing stuff rather than just measuring stuff. And the other thing is, invariably, there isn't just the one piece of the jigsaw that's standing alone. At the same time as you're running a major PR campaign, you're also running a major advertising campaign. There's a whole lot of other activity that's occurring at the same time. And I don't think many people dispute that that's the most effective way of communicating. But what it does do is make evaluation really difficult, particularly, I think, with PR, because people are consuming it in a less overt way. So if you're trying to ask people about how they might have reached this opinion or might have formed this view, whereas they might recall a TV ad that had a very stark image that they can recount back. They're less likely to recall a 90-second clip on TV on a TV news bulletin that sort of reinforced that, or a newspaper article that had the same messages coming through but actually added validity to it.
Vanessa, you were going to say something before Ron pulled his chairman rank.
It's very different, I think, in the arts community, because our measure a lot of the time is actually getting the attention of government, because you are constantly fighting for government funding, government attention to be put on cabinet agendas, to be put on economic review committee agendas. So to get a meeting is, you know, an absolute indicator that you've grabbed media attention, because you have to constantly try and garner and elicit, you know, a public support for your institution, because, you know, we're dealing with taxpayers' funds.
I keep hearing all these terms bounced around, things like, you know, for example, KPIs and measurements, and call to actions are something that I keep hearing again and again. What's that about, Ron? What's a call to action, and why do all my advertisers want one?
Well, because that's the commercial end benefit of the expenditure.
Oh, there you go.
I mean, if you don't have a call to action and you don't get a response, then there was no point investing the money in the first place. In Vanessa's, your call to action is come and buy tickets here, or get on the web and do this, or come to this place, because at the end of the day, if she doesn't sell tickets, she doesn't have a comedy festival.
Thanks, Ron.
I have a hypothetical question here that someone has provided for me, but our guests have already heard the question, so what's the point of asking them a hypothetical if they've heard it? So I need to think of an alternative. Let's pretend that each of you got a phone call from the agent of a South American white-collar criminal. He's living in Australia and he's just been busted. His children have grown up here. He's now in the prison, the major prison down there, I forget what it's called. But his children are going to Melbourne High. Actually, they're probably going to Scotch. He's a white-collar criminal with loaded amounts of money in the bank. You get the phone call from his agent. He's been busted. He's in an Australian prison, and there is talk of him being extradited to his native South American country. In that set of circumstances, what would be the first thing that you would do, Vanessa?
What am I doing for him?
He doesn't want to be extradited. And between you and me, would you prefer to be at the prison down there or the one in the South American country? He doesn't want to be extradited, and his children are going to Scotch. And his wife is living here?
Well, I'd be finding out as much as possible about what his activities were in South America and deciding whether I wanted to take the gig or not. And, I guess that there would then be... Oh, God, I would never do any of this. What am I talking about?
That's your answer.
He's paying you a lot of money. Unmarked bills, brown paper envelopes.
If you knew how much I earned, you would know that that really is not going to play a major factor in any of this.
But he's a strong supporter of the arts.
That's better if you actually say he's my principal sponsor or something like that.
That's right.
So I have to say,
great sense of humour, loves comedy.
Well, I could today tonight it and turn him into a model citizen, or I could distance myself and talk about people's wrongdoing, and he was under an oppressive government in South America and he had to make ends meet and he's contributed so much to the Australian economy, and can we just forget it?
Nice. Rely on a human rights issue.
Yeah.
Why would you send this man to a dungeon in South America when he deserves decent treatment in an Australian jail?
Yep, and we can just prolong that through the legal courts for 10 to 20 years. Nice. And hopefully we'll be buried.
Would advertising play a role in that equation, Ron?
No. No, it's the first, I mean, the discipline here is the PR one, and I think there's two ways to go about it, and there's no right or wrong way. It's a matter of personal conscience. I mean, if you're in Anton's position as a principal of a PR company, and to report to me, and I know what we would do in either of our PR companies if we were given that brief, and the answer would be we wouldn't touch it. But that doesn't mean to say you shouldn't. I mean, you can take the view that you're a taxi for hire, which is what we are, and you're not the moral policeman, and you're not responsible and vested with the responsibility of making those decisions, and take it on as a commercial project within that PR company. Or I think you could equally take the view that it's against your own moral position and you walk away from it. And I don't think either of those are wrong. It's just a question of your own perspective. In our case, I wouldn't allow either of the two PR companies that report to me to handle that project if it was a crystal clear case of... I mean, if he's a political prisoner, that's a different thing. If he's a embezzler or some other thing and it's a pretty clear issue, we just wouldn't need that work.
Anton's been sitting here very quietly to my right. Now, this is the sort of case that a lot of PR firms are occasionally confronted with.
Yep. And in fact, we have been confronted with a couple of opportunities over the last 18 months. Not the same, but similar. And we turned both of them down. I suppose as to what I would do if I was doing it, I think probably the good analogy is Jihad Jack. And I hate the fact that that's the only name I know him by, because that's because of government spin. That they have labelled him Jihad Jack, and that's what the media run with, and so that's how we all know him, and that's got its own connotations. But whatever the poor bloke's real name is, Jihad Jack, I actually think he or influences of him tried quite hard before his Melbourne trial to position him in the way that Vanessa was sort of talking. I watched with interest. Australian Story did a big piece on him, and then I think it was sort of at the same time 60 Minutes was taking quite the populist view of, you know, this bloke's clearly a terrorist. But I actually thought it backfired on him. I actually thought his story didn't convince me in any way. And so what they were trying to do was win the case in the public forum. And I actually think that you need to be absolutely confident of your talent to be able to do that, and I actually don't think he pulled it off.
So this was an example of Jihad Jack taking the front foot.
Yep.
And sadly, I don't know his name either. But taking the front foot and trying to salvage his reputation after the papers had labelled him with that name. Do you believe he was advised in that instance?
I have no doubt he was. What you saw was two very concurrent but different approaches from media. You had those who had access to him, who were obviously given that access on the basis that it was perceived friendly reporters. So you had Australian Story, and you had the Australian or the Weekend Age doing a major feature of him, and this was all happening sort of in the space of a week. You had at the same time the Herald Sun sort of front paging him a couple of times in that week with major pieces, and 60 Minutes doing a major piece where they didn't have direct access to him. They'd obviously refused that access. And so you had competing forces trying to tell their story, because there was no doubt that the federal government was feeding a lot of stuff for the tabloid press and for the 60 Minutes of the world. And you had, I've no doubt, friends and family of Jack who were trying to identify where there were some potential positive media opportunities.
Why didn't it work? You said that for you it didn't feel like it worked.
I actually just think his story was a little too compelling. You go through it all, and this is a very much a personal view, but you know, if I was a jury member and my evidence was what I saw on TV and read in the paper, I probably still would have convicted him. And so for me, it actually just came down to the facts. I just thought it was interesting, personality-wise, how they tried to portray him, or how they did portray him. And look, if I was in his position, I'd be giving it a shot.
So you'd give him a shot?
No. I'm saying I would be giving it a shot to do what he did, as in I would be trying to use the media in the way that he did. Ultimately, it wasn't successful for him.
Well, my hypothetical went completely off the rails, but that was quite interesting, so I was happy that we went there. I have a quote here from Neil Shoebridge of the Australian Financial Review, and he once wrote, The marketing industry is full of people who are experts at using a strange combination of research and gut feel to disguise a bad idea and convince their bosses that it will work.
Did I say the words gut feel earlier?
Maybe.
No, we threw it.
Vanessa, how can anyone be sure that an idea presented by a marketing department will work?
You can't.
Short and sweet.
It's absolutely no way you can.
Good answer.
Because it's also, it's the same as the market. To try and suggest that the market is something that is solid and preserved is ridiculous as well. Capitalism is an ever-changing structure, and as is marketing, as a people, as a society, as a cultures, as our opinions. And, you know, we can have situations where, and it's happened a number of times at festivals, that you promote a show that you think is going to, you know, completely take off, and then something happens in the press that there is absolutely no way you could have known was going to happen that will adversely affect sales in a particular show. And while you could have looked at that show 6 months ago and said, that is going to work, you know, it's going to be fantastic, you can't see all the other things. So you have to, I think, relinquish control.
In terms of a scenario where you have a client that you need to please, is trial and error ever allowed into the equation, Ron?
In terms of testing ideas, do you mean?
I don't know. I wish someone would come and speak to my board every time I try something and it doesn't work.
Let me see if I understand the question. I mean, firstly, I would say about Neil's quote is that it's a fairly sensationalist thing to say, because businesses need to have an end result and they have to have a commercial outcome. That's what I always say about advertising, whether it's advertising or PR or whatever it is. I mean, if everyone sat around unsure of what to do and not doing anything, then nothing would happen and we'd all go broke. So the fact of the matter is, you know, the world's not a perfect place, but most companies do get things done, and advertising is one, and PR is another thing they get done, and they get a result and they make a profit and they return some of that money to the shareholders. So to say that unconditionally is obviously stupid, because it's just blatantly not true. But as Vanessa suggests, it's not a science, and you don't always get the outcome you want, and you can't always be sure that you're going to get the outcome you want. But
also, mistakes can be valuable.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say that. I mean, you know, I've read and been accused of being in an industry where we influence people to do things they don't want to do. And I often think of the failures that I've been involved in, and if we had that power, I can assure you we wouldn't have gone through those painful and damaging experiences. But the truth of it is, you do things in good faith and based on, you know, objectivity and experience and knowledge, and you try and overlay as much science as you can on the decision-making process and the process of the creative development process to minimise the risk profile. But we're in a subjective business, whether we like it or not. Human behaviour is subjective, and that's the thing we're trying to understand and communicate with. So you add as much objectivity as you can, but the nature of the beast is subjective, so you can't have a guarantee going into that process. And any client who's at all informed and intelligent and worldly will know there's a risk, but there's a risk in opening a business. There's a risk in building a product. There's a risk in every aspect of business and government and everything we do. There's no way to eradicate that part out of advertising or any of the communication skills. And the trial and error part, if I understand the question, I mean, we use that all the time. We try and test. We just had a client or a prospect come to us, really, a small company that wants to do some television advertising. And what we'll do for them is trial a couple of things and see if our gut feel and what little science we can overlay on that business is right by testing something in the market before they go out spending a lot of their shareholder funds on on marketing and advertising. Does that answer that question?
Yes, it does. Yeah, I was interested in the testing in the trial area. We've got a couple minutes before we open it for questions. So just very quickly, Ron, best advertising, worst advertising you can think of.
Oh God. Oh. Well, look, to be absolutely
just an easy one.
To be absolutely blunt, the best advertising is the advertising that has the best return on investment. And the worst advertising is advertising that fails. It's really that simple because, you know, I could say, well, the ad I like is the big ad. But you see, we're not in the business of art for art's sake. We're in the business of generating profit for our clients or changing public opinion in the case of government or social organisation, whatever it is. But getting that outcome that they set out to achieve. So that's the difference. That's good advertising and bad advertising. And I could rattle off campaigns that were highly successful and some of which you wouldn't remember, but that's good and bad advertising. Not ads that I like and don't like.
I was actually looking for the real lead ballooner. I love those stories. In PR, you always talk about the great stories and the great triumphs and the great PR triumphs. And at the same time, there is always an example of something that went horribly wrong. Mm. You gave us an example 2 seconds ago of something that didn't convince you. If I was to ask you a similar question to Ron, 2 campaigns, highly effective, highly ineffective. If it's too hard, we'll move to questions.
No, the ineffective probably stands out more. I think maybe you just remember the disasters more, but I think things like Shell, Esso with Longford was a classic example where there was a very much a single focus of approach that they took. And what I'm talking here about, there was the big explosion down at the gas plant in Gippsland. I think it was 2 workers that were killed. The company was taking legal advice on what they should be saying publicly, and that was about limiting liability because they were worried about all these claims that were going to come down the track from people whose businesses had been affected from disrupted gas supplies. So, you know, they had a very much a commercial imperative, but what they did was effectively sheet the blame onto 2 blokes who were dead, who were working for their company, who had died for their company. And what you saw then was a massive sort of swing in public opinion against the company as a result of that. And I think as a corporate entity, that was something that was an absolute PR disaster because they were taking only one perspective on the issue. And it certainly wasn't easy. The answer to that one was never going to be easy, but I think that they stuffed it up. With something like an oil company, it's, you know, the ramifications of that probably aren't as great as if they were selling peanut butter. Because at the end of the day, you know, you don't know who's been mining your gas anyway when you turn your heater on, and B, you've got no choice about who you use anyway, so you're still going to be doing it.
And probably some of the best examples are less visible because they did such a great job.
Yeah, certainly from an issues management perspective, that's the case. I mean, look, one that I've been intimately involved in over sort of an extended period has been the road safety campaign here in Victoria, and I think that why that has been so successful is it has been a true integration of various marketing disciplines. And so you've seen, I think, really effective above-the-line advertising combined with very effective PR over an extended period. And in an environment where I've since learnt, having sort of come out of TAC, that in other fields you'll have a client being the government, which is quite uncomfortable with taking the PR approach that TAC has taken. And TAC has traditionally taken the scare approach of talking up how bad things are to try and get people to change their behaviour. Now, a lot of governments are really scared to do that because it actually reflects on them, or they perceive that it reflects on them. But I actually think that's been a really effective PR and sort of integrated marketing campaign over the course of sort of 15 years or so.
Vanessa, rather than looking at campaigns, let's look to the future. Where do you think that marketing is heading in terms of positives? Are there any great new technology trends or non-technology related trends in the marketing world that
Well, I guess
that's
a very big question.
Very big question, very broad question.
It's a very broad question. I guess for festivals and particularly arts-based industries, we are looking at the moment, obviously, as the web as being the prime focus, that people will have the capacity to be able to go to the web, download audio, download video, be able to get reviews both from press, be able to download TV and see what actually got reviewed, be able to review blogs, and it becomes this one-stop shop that you could then, you know, purchase tickets online, not only print tickets, or the capacity to be watching, say, the gala, the Comedy Festival gala, and that an SMS number will come up when you see an artist that you like. You SMS them, it comes back as a video stream saying, hi, I hope you come to the show. This is when it's available, click here to purchase, and then we SMS back the barcode, which is in fact their ticket to enter the venue. So they haven't left their seat. They've haven't had to do a single thing other than press the buttons.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, which is really interesting for ticketing. I mean, there's a lot of problems with verifying users of phones and all those sort of issues at the moment. But it's fascinating for us because there's a real monopoly, particularly on how people get their information in the arts, because there are only about, you know, 6 to 7 reviewers for the Comedy Festival across Victoria. And when you look at the statistics of how many people go to shows based on reviews in the paper, you think, well, we have an audience of roughly 350,000 to 400,000 people. 53% of our audience say they have to have a review beforehand, which means those 7 people are controlling their opinion, which is terrible for smaller artists that don't get reviewed. So if there are capacities for the, particularly the web, to carry user reviews, as well as garnering other local artists and local reviewers to have that information up, a lot of control is relinquished from those 7 people, which is good, and it broadens it, democratises marketing.